Hi there, short film fans, and welcome to another episode of the Cameo Launch Short Film Podcast. I'm your host, Nigel Morgan. Joining me today, we have two very special guests and the makers of our most recently reviewed film, The Visit. Jake Murray and Paul Ludden are joining us from Durham and Manchester. Thank you very much for joining us, guys. How are you?
Good.
Thank you. Yeah, very good. Nice to see you.
Thanks for coming on the show. Just as a bit of context for anybody who hasn't quite seen it yet, can you just tell us a little bit about what The Visit is about and its kind of historical context? Maybe, Paul, do you want to jump in with this one?
I'm of an age. I was born in the 70s. So, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, I was very aware of the IRA and what was going on with that kind of situation. And in 96, when the Manchester bomb happened, I was 26 years old, kind of was down there the next day. I was at home at the time when it went off, which is in a place called Moston, which is quite a few miles away from the city centre. But I heard the boom in the back garden. Next day, as you do, I was down there looking at it. Very, very surreal. And that kind of moment stuck with me for a long, long time. And the thing that stuck with me, I knew about the troubles. I knew I had mates who were serving over there at the time. I knew there were bombs going off. I knew there was a peace process. I'd not took that much notice, if I'm honest. But then when you go down there and you see all this damage, and the thing that kind of, and still does, spun round my head was that, and especially when more information started coming out, was that you've got two guys who drive a lorry full of explosives. It's still the biggest explosion on mainland Britain since the Second World War. But drive that into a city centre on a busy Saturday afternoon in the middle of Euro 96. So you had people from all over the world there. It was extremely busy. Park it up, get out, lock the door, stick the hazards on, and walk away. And I could never understand that. I mean, it's a massively grey area in terms of the troubles. And the older you get and the more research you do, the more you get to understand it. But that stuck with me, that story. So you've got these two guys who walk away, go back to Ireland, probably, and then live the lives. And what happened to them? How did they think about it? Why did they do it? Well, probably know why they did it. Or one of the main reasons why they did it. That story's always been around the bomb, definitely, but the bombers, that has always stuck with me. That how can you do that? Because, you know, they talk about terrorism. I don't think it comes in any worse form than planting a bomb. You know, and that's where the genesis of the story came. You know, around what happened to them and you know, certainly 26, 27 years later, which is when the visit is around that kind of time. So assuming that, you know, these guys were in the mid-20s, you know, they're going to be in the late 50s, mid-50s, probably may have done time in prison, may have got families, may think differently about it, may not think differently about it at all, maybe massively proud of what they did. Nobody knows, really. So, you know, it's a fictional story. The Visit is a fictional story based around an actual event. So that's the thing that, you know, I try and emphasize is there's a bit creative license in there. But yeah, that's the genesis of it.
Okay. So Paul, you as writer and producer of the film, you're kind of driven to that. It sounds like it's something that is, well, the event itself is something that stuck with you for a long time, well, since it actually happened. What was it that kind of made you decide to write this story now?
I wanted to make a film.
Yeah.
Simple. You know, we've made some short films. You know, we've done really, you know, man-made productions. We do podcasts. We do audio drama. And I'm a massive believer that don't just talk about something. You know, if you want to show people what can be done, then go out and do it. And so it was as simple as that. It was like, you know, before Lee Child got involved, I'd written this film, we'd cast it more or less. Jake was on, Cal was on board. And we had a budget. I was obviously a little bit frightened about the budget that we had right. at the time, that I never really told everyone how much it was. And obviously Lee's involvement allowed us to kind of, A, make sure everyone got paid and get better equipment. But it's still a small budget film. You know, it's still a film that's, you know, under 18 grand.
Right.
Which is surprises a lot of people when they look at it, because it does look so cinematic. And 60% of that went on paying people.
Right.
So yeah, it was purely a thing of, no, I want to make a film. Now when I wrote it, and you know, 80% of it is based on location, I knew I was going to make it, and I'd find a way of making it, but didn't realize how difficult it was going to be. So you know, maybe I would have changed a few things. Maybe not. As it turned out, I think it makes the film that, or one of the things that makes the film is the fact that we did film it on location, and I've got a film that looks cinematic that I hope people enjoy. And the story is the most important thing, and the performances. But just to show people what you can do. I mean, I'm not saying for a second that, you know, 17 and a half grand isn't a lot of money. It is. But from a small film point of view, it's not massive by any stretch of the imagination. You'll know better than me, mate. So yeah, it was just a case of, yeah, let's do it. Wrote it and then got Jake. I think sent it through to Jake a week after I'd written it. Wanted to work with Jake. Jake's a mate, an amazing theatre director. I knew he'd do a great job with this because it was all about performances for me. Jake said, yeah. Didn't have much choice, I don't think. and then we started kind of pushing it forward.
Right. Okay. I mean, it's clearly a film with a lot of ambition behind it, and it is something that very much speaks to one of the more turbulent times of this country's sort of modern history. So, Jake, when Paul approached you with this project, with you as director, what were your first thoughts, basically based on the pitch, and also once you read the scripts, what were your first thoughts in terms of how do I tackle this?
I didn't actually get a pitch, I don't think. I think you just sent me the scripts. So I read the script very quickly because it's a very readable script, and it was right up my street, basically. If there's two things that, I mean, as Paul says, I'm a theatre director, I've been directing for 30 years. If there's two big themes that come up a lot in the stuff that I do, one is anti-political violence. One is violence in general, the use of violence to great political ends, and the tragedy of that and what that does to people. And the other is the question about what is a life, and that life seen in its entirety. So a lot of my theatre work has been about those two things, and this script did both of them. So you know, you've got the huge subject of what does it mean to use violence for political ends? What do you have to do to yourself? How far do you have to go to get to the point where you don't care, willing to kill someone on the other end? Do you know what I mean? And I think the big, you know, there's a lot of argument as to what's a terrorist and what isn't. The specific thing about terrorism is it's aimed at a civilian population. So there's that question, because the world, as we know right now, is plunged into these conflicts again. We're not growing out of it. And the other is this whole thing of the film is also about a man reckoning with his life, and having to go over the choices he's made and work out whether they're right choices, whether they're wrong choices. And although Paul hasn't written a script which preaches, it is about someone coming to the end of their life with sort of nothing. Their biggest supposed achievement has just been built over. And I remember us talking, Paul and I, about how actually the weird thing was that rather than destroying the city, the 1996 bomb made it. The regeneration that happened after 96, along with the Commonwealth Games, has turned Manchester into the extraordinary city that it is now.
Right.
I love the fact that it was very concise. There's not one bit of fat on it. I love the fact that what Paul wrote, the city was a character. You know what I mean? And that's big tribute to Yenny, our cinematographer, who filmed it that way and managed to make the city into a personality rather than just a grey backdrop. It's sometimes hard to I always think it's a thing on British television and films. Sometimes we fail to do what the Americans do, which is to mythologize our cities. And she's managed to do that. So the city is very vivid and alive and a character and a really powerful backdrop. And of course, that's, although I'm not a native of Manchester, that's where most of my life has been. There was something fantastic about going back to the city and doing that. So but the main thing was I just thought it was a fantastic script with something to say. And it's a tragedy. When I'm pleased when I watched it is it's very short, but there's enough kind of emotional complexity there for a whole film. You don't feel you've just seen that's nice. You actually feel you've gone through something, and that's a tribute to the writing, really.
No, absolutely. And one of the things that struck me about it, in terms of the complexity, is the only real human connection that gets made in the story are between two former enemy combatants, basically. So you've got this former member of the IRA going back to the scene of, as you're saying, his greatest accomplishment, which is now being built of, which is an interesting character facet in and of itself. But then speaking with a taxi driver who used to be a British soldier deployed in Northern Ireland. So they would have been each other's targets at some point, and here they are having this really interesting introspective conversation. And that's really the only real connection that gets made. So how much a part of that dynamic was involved in the way that you approached directing their performances?
Well, it was an interesting one, that one, because I think Trevor himself was a squaddy in Northern Ireland. I think he did a couple of tours, so he was actually drawing on his own experience playing the part. I think we did a lot of talking about that, that interesting thing of how the strange thing about mortal enemies is that when the cause is over, the only other person who understands what the experience like is your mortal enemy. Do you know what I mean? Is that actually both the two men are cut loose in the world. The most formative experience of their lives was the Troubles. And now 30 years on, 20 years on, whatever it is, no one knows what that is except for them. Do you know what I mean? So we did talk a little bit about wanting to create a kind of tension in the car as to where was this going to go?
Yeah.
Where they're going to suddenly kick off, where they're going to face each other. Is it like a Western? Because neither of them actually says, well, I mean, you know, Cal's character says, well, you were a squaddy, and the guy admits it. But the impression you get is that Trevor's character also guesses who Cal's character is. They both know who the other one is. But the weird thing there is that years later, I mean, that's the love-hate relationship of Mortal Enemies, isn't it? That's why those people never want a peace to happen, because if a peace happens 20 years down the line, everything they've done is meaningless. I think we had quite a lot of fun filming that, of driving around Manchester with Cal doing the scene 48 times, and then driving around it with Trevor doing it, with me reading in for Cal, at which point Paul said, I didn't know you could do a Welsh accent, so thank you for that. It was really interesting for me, because obviously I'm primarily a theatre director. This is only the second short film I've ever made. And learning how different the process is, because obviously in theatre you work in real time with the actors who then perform it in real time. With a film, the two actors were never in the car together. Do you know right. what I mean? Which is always so fascinating. Well, what you don't see on the screen.
Just to say, they were in the car. We had a bit of an issue with... We filmed that scene at the end. It was the last scene we filmed in the car. The first scene was the last scene we filmed. And, you know, we were in a bit of a rush, you know, and there was a lot of guerrilla filmmaking in terms of making right. that happen, and health and safety kind of pushed to one side. But I think it adds to it. And they were in the car. So Trevor was driving that car and performing and trying to deal with the traffic. And having the people in the car. I was in the car in front, sort of leading the way, and we were recording the audio in that car. We had to go back and record some of the, I think next day we did Trevor's lines.
Right.
I think that relationship is just, I mean, they got on really well. Trevor and Cal clicked. I mean, Trevor knows everyone in the world. He probably knows you, Nigel, somewhere down low. He knows everyone. He's a top bloke, really, really good friend of mine. But he was in the film because I knew that he would smash this part, and he did. And I think that relationship, you can, I think it's the heart of the film. I think that scene is the one that I'm the most proud of. But yeah, I think the fact that they clicked as well, kind of, because they all went out for something to eat the night before while I was organising everything, and had a great night. But that was, you know, that was the best thing that could have happened, because, you know, they found that connection.
Right. I remember that night, because after we'd eaten, we all ended up in a hotel, I think, having a drink, and Cal wanted to talk about the characters, and of course, the fact that Trevor had been in Belfast throughout the whole thing meant that Cal had that in person, because Cal's Scottish, he's not actually Northern Irish. Trevor was talking about it, and I remember something that Trevor said, because he was talking about his direct experience of it, and the, you know, losing friends who got killed out there, and the sense of danger and threat. But he also said something really interesting, which I think is quite universal with all these conflicts in the world. He said the difficulty was that both sides of the conflict had good reasons for what they were doing. It was just what they were doing was terrible. Do you know what I mean? Both sides could argue, we're doing this because you did this to us. And there was no way of denying the fact that those things have been done, but the use of violence was not necessarily the best way of resolving it. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's the complexity of all these conflicts, is that we like to see them as good and evil, but each person has their narrative as to why what they're doing is good. You know what I mean? And why we're, and also even sometimes we know it's bad, but we have to do it because.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I remember being present at a talk that a man called Giovanni Pico, I think he was, or Gianni Pico, who was a UN peace negotiator. And he was the guy who negotiated the end of the Iran-Iraq war. And he also was the one who negotiated the release of some of the hostages in Beirut when Hezbollah was holding them in Beirut, which is a chapter that we've forgotten about Hezbollah. And he told the story about how when he was taken to meet Nasrallah, who was the leader of Hezbollah and still is, he was stripped naked and a hood was put over his head, and he was driven to this place. And he said that all the way on his way, the young Hezbollah fighters were explaining to him why they were doing it.
Right.
They were saying, look, we know this is a terrible thing. We don't want to do these violent things. We don't want to take people hostages, but you have to understand. And then we talked about the Lebanese civil war, do you know what I mean? And all of that kind of stuff. So it was, he said that what was strange about it was they were very, very keen to convince me that they were bad people. And then when he eventually got to Nasrallah and he was tied to a chair completely naked and the hood was taken off and they were negotiating, Nasrallah said, why are you doing this? These aren't your people. You know, these hostages are not your family. And Pico said, I'm doing this because there may come a time when my children or my grandchildren are in danger and your grandchildren or children could be the only ones who could save them.
That's very interesting.
And that was apparently what persuaded Nasrallah to let them go, was this thing of we're fighting this present battle, but we also have to think about the future generations who might not want to fight this battle. And you sometimes think it would be really nice if we thought that way a little bit more.
That's really interesting. I mean, it's the kind of story that really does kind of evoke all these very, very deep questions that kind of get to the heart of the conflicts we put so much of our cultural and national identity behind as well. You know, things that can stir up so much fervor or pride or hatred that when you kind of end up in a one-on-one, face-to-face kind of situation, as you pointed out, Jake, you end up face-to-face with the only other person who understands what you've been going through or understands your point of view. That I think is one of the more interesting things about this story. And also you touched a little bit on Manchester as a city, it being kind of a character in the story. I think one of the things that really makes that work is number one, the way it's shot, which is amazing. and number two, the use of the footage you were able to find at the time, the stock footage you were able to find from that era. How difficult was it to get a hold of that? It must be quite difficult footage to get a hold of in that kind of quantity to use for this kind of a project.
No, I mean it's all available. Little bit of a grey area as to who owns some of it, because some of it was filmed by different organisations, and obviously we credited where we needed to credit it. But there's quite a lot of footage around it. When you think of going back to 96, it was probably around that time where we started seeing. I mean, Sky was around then, obviously Sky News, but it was where we started seeing more of when things happened. We were there pretty quickly, so yeah, there's a fair bit of footage around it. And you're right, that was getting Andy, who did the editing, we knew where. I mean, in the script it says, you know, footage would be shown and maybe a little bit of detail, and we sourced that footage between us and put it on there. But Andy has done an amazing job. He's the editor of how he put that in with the reactions, obviously with Cal. But yeah, it's another character without a shadow of a doubt. And you know, I think there was a couple of bits that he found that like the helicopter, the scene with the helicopter. I mean, when it actually happened, typical Manx. You know, they were being told to leave the city centre, and basically the response was no, we're not leaving this, because we kind of had bomb threats, and we were kind of used to it. And then the police helicopter, that helicopter you see, came into the city centre and was relatively low, and they were using the speaker and they were saying get out the city centre, and that's when people realised it was serious, and was like, oh, okay. And is the really famous footage, our infamous footage, which we have in there, of the van parked there.
Yeah.
People
just walking
past it. I mean, I think it had 5 or 6 parking tickets on it.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, they're keen now, but they were very keen then. 5 or 6 parking tickets, people walking past. I've spoke to a number of people who walked past it on the day. Didn't think twice about it. And it's just frightening. Frightening to think if that would have gone off when the people were around it, hundreds of people would have been killed. And that's not being melodramatic.
Yeah.
Where that was, hundreds and hundreds of people would have got killed. And yeah, forget the damage to the buildings. I'm not bothered about the buildings. You know, bricks and mortar never doesn't bother me in anything that I do. It's like the flesh and blood side of it that I'm bothered about. So yeah, we were so lucky on that day. So lucky.
And once you actually start putting all of that together and you start seeing the story kind of develop visually, what are your initial thoughts? Does it kind of take you back to then? Does it kind of, you know, set you to thinking about alternative perspectives of those same events, or force you to reconsider where we are now? What were your thoughts when you first started seeing the film coming together, both of you?
I've done a lot of research. I mean, Northern Ireland's a really interesting time for me, because I know people who served there, family, friends. I would have joined the army around 86, 87. The thing that put me off joining was Northern Ireland. A few weeks ago, I spent a week in Belfast, went over to do some research because I'm now working on the feature-length scripts based on the visit. First time over there.
Right.
Spent a day on the Falls Road. Which I wouldn't have done 10 years ago, let alone 20, 25 years ago, just to kind of see what the situation, and the overwhelming, and I've said this to Jake, the overwhelming feeling I got from spending time in Belfast, speaking to people, spending time on the Falls Road, was there's a huge amount of hope there, albeit it's still a bad situation. There are still people trying to bring them back to where it was, trying to recreate that kind of, you know, the situation from the 70s, 80s, 90s. But I don't think they will ever allow it to go back to what it was. So I feel a massive responsibility. When you're writing about a situation that may have touched me in my home city, but it doesn't compare to what the people were living through day in, day out in Northern Ireland. So, you know, that footage from the time itself, I just remember it being massively surreal to go into town and see it. And it was, you know, I'm not going to lie, it was exciting to a certain extent, because it's like, you know, it's on your doorstep. You don't think as a 26-year-old the impact of it. You just think, wow, look at this, you know, and all the police were around, and maybe you'd see police with guns, which you'd never see on the streets back then. But yeah, it kind of, and that got me interested in the situation in Northern Ireland, I say, from that point, but also my connection with the city, with Manchester, from that occasion became stronger. Whereas Manchester just used to be a place, I was born in Manchester and I went to town or Manchester city centre of a weekend and whatever, but I felt a connection. It was that kind of, you can't just come into my city and do that.
Yeah.
You know, it was that real visceral kind of thing. That's what, when I look at that footage now, that's what I think. I think of where we are now and how things have changed and the people that I've spoken to on both sides and where they are now compared to where they were 30 years ago. It's mind blowing that we're in a place where there is peace. I mean, there's still problems, but yeah, it's just a situation I never thought I would see ever.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what looking at that footage does to me, really.
Yeah. What about yourself, Jake? What goes through your mind when you kind of see, well, the footage plus the film as it comes together? What goes through your mind in terms of what was happening at that time and where we are now?
Well, it's a funny one, because I wasn't actually in Manchester when it happened. I was weirdly enough, I was struggling as a theatre director, had no money, and I actually had got my very first ever holiday abroad that I've managed to earn money for. So I was actually not in the country when it happened. But I remember it happening, and I came back not long afterwards, and it had a huge impact on my family, because my parents, or my father was one of the artistic directors of the Royal Exchange Theatre, which was just around the corner from where the bomb went off, and that they were driven out of the theatre because it became structurally dangerous, they had to remount themselves in the covered market on Deansgate for 2 years. So there was this whole kind of campsite quality to the theatre for it. So I knew very much about the impact of it. I mean, for me, it's that thing, isn't it? Of the 90s are so, when you grow up, you don't notice everything changing.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like recently, I did just last week, I was doing a play in Birmingham, which was set in 1996, the year it all happened. Australian play, and suddenly you were looking at all the differences. Like, there was no one had mobile phones, not like they do now. There were things like phone boxes, which you don't really have now. The clothes were different, the music that you listened to was different, everything was different, the pace was different. I was just thinking about what said about in the 90s, no one really lived in the center of town, they lived outside it. You, as Paul says, you went into town, shop or to, you know, have a drink or see something, but you didn't stay there that night. Now everybody, you know, I had a flat in the center of town for years. Just that awareness of how life changes, how we look the same but we're not the same. I mean, and I remember that when we were filming, Trevor was driving me around. And he kept on going, oh, that's where I grew up. And I was thinking, why is he doing this? Why is he showing me all these places that were? And then I realized, of course, as we were driving around, and all the places I remember had changed.
Yeah.
I realized just how quickly the process that Paul's talking about of everything that was important to you is gone. Mm. I mean, everything, I'm coming away saying to, I'm working with some students, just be aware, hold on to what you've got now, because in 20 years' time, it won't mean anything to anybody. Mm. You know, it doesn't matter that this was the street corner where I first got drunk, or that was where, you know, I had my first date, or do you know what I mean? Because it doesn't matter to people now, because things have changed. And I think that's part of what the film is about. The film is about change, and how, in a weird kind of way, transient our lives are. Do you know what I mean? At a certain point, the only thing that's important is our life is what we remember. The idea, because the monument for him would have been a huge devastated city. And part of the point of the scene in the bar is that he's sitting there having a drink and none of the people around him have a clue who he is or what he did. And the city's just bustling along happy and alive. Do you know what I mean? That was actually based on a film called The Battle for Algiers, which is about the terrorist campaign, liberation campaign in Algeria. And that feeling of life going on around him was the goal. So I think it's about, it doesn't so much as recapture for me the events of what happened, but it resonates with me about what the journey of life is.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think these are the things that help a short film work when the backdrop of it is something so huge, because, you know, honestly, putting anything to film or on a screen is just fraught with challenges and expense and all sorts. But I think the things that make it work in a short film is when you're able to distill all of that, all those massive, you know, world-changing historical events down to a really simple personal interaction between two people. Which this does really, really well. So much of it is introspective and is done actually without words as well. And, you know, it tells the story of this guy. I wouldn't even call it regret. It's too complex to call it any one thing. You know, I don't get the impression that he regrets what he did, nor do I get the impression that he's looking around thinking, you know, I failed. You know, there is kind of a bit of reverence and amazement in the way that he's kind of taking in this city that he once tried to destroy, and he doesn't seem to begrudge it at all either. You know, it's complex in all those kinds of ways, and when you're able to kind of focus on those aspects, that's what can really help a short film with such a massive subject matter really, really work, especially, you know, when you're talking about time constraints and all of that kind of stuff, and trying to tell a contained story in that time frame as well. What were some of the influences you were able to draw on artistically that kind of informed the way that you approached, in your case, Paul, the writing, in your case, Jake, the directing of the film?
I like stories, I like film where they don't give you all the answers. And that's not particularly popular nowadays. The amount of people who say, "Well, what was you thinking? What did he?" And it's like, "Well, I don't know. What do you think?" I mean, what you've just said, Nigel, is basically what I was thinking, more or less, when I wrote that. I don't think he, you know, in my mind, does he regret doing it? No, not at all, because he would have gone home a hero.
Yeah.
What happened after that, and what happened? The decision that the core of that film is the decision that he makes in that film to do something that then he has to live with for the rest of his life is the heart of that film. But yeah, I love watching things that don't give you all the answers, not to the point where at the end you go, "What was that about?" It's, you know, that is every single program that's on ITV or whatever. You think, "Well, you know, I've just wasted, you know, 11 hours watching that." So yeah, you know, something that asks questions, but not in a, you know, "Aren't I clever" sort of way. Just, you know, that's what life is. Life goes like that. Sometimes, a lot of the time, you don't get the answers you're looking for.
No.
So yeah, that definitely, when I was writing it, that's what I tried to, that's what I tried to bring to it.
Well, for me, so I think, yeah, the film I mentioned, The Battle for Algiers, was an influence on it. I mean, I love cinema, so film, I mean, I'm what's always appealed, I think a period of film that I love is the Verite era, you know, the kind of, and one of the things I said to Yenny was, I don't want a filter on this. I mean, I think there is a bit of filter on it, but I didn't want, what always frustrates me is whenever you put the television on or you go to see a film, and if it's a horror movie, everything is through a kind of gangrenous green filter. If it's a medieval story, it's through a brown filter, and or everything gets enhanced, and you're not seeing sort of something truthful. So what I wanted was that quality of, what I don't know whether we got it, that feeling of something like Dog Day Afternoon or Taxi Driver or, you know, the French cinema, you know, the cinema verite, the Truffaut, all that kind of stuff, where it's very much, it's telling a very simple, clear story, but with the real world, it's very much the kind of landscape of it. I mean, there's. We also wanted to create that kind of dreamlike atmosphere that a city can have. Like, I remember we had an accidental moment where the tram went by when we were filming the walk to the pillar box, and we definitely kept that in. It's things like, I think Alphaville, you know, the Godard movie is like that. So film obviously had a big influence on me. Then also theatre and other art forms. The Peer Gynt by Ibsen, where the last act is about Peer going back to his childhood and encountering all the people that he knew when he was young, much older, and having a reckoning about his life. And also some of those great last works of art by people like T.S. Eliot, like Four Quartets, where someone is summing up their entire life. That feeling, and I think that's the interesting thing, is I suppose something for me is that life does have a value. And while we may be looking for answers and meaning, in the end, the only thing that's important is what's meaningful to us. And I think the film is partly about that, is him trying to find some kind of meaning, whether it's a positive or negative, we don't know. And I think that's what makes it work, is it's a universal story, really, about someone trying to come to terms with their life. So everything, really. So theatre, literature, film, and also my own experience of being a human, you know, which is where you sit there often sitting and dreaming and daydreaming about who you are and what are you doing and where are we going, and all of that goes in. I will add, I want to quickly name check him, is that I think a lot of the depth and the complexity of the film comes from Cal's performance, which is so light touch, and yet he suggests so much going on underneath, and that's very much the kind of actor that Cal is. And I think not all actors want to do that. It's quite a lot of, I mean, I'm as a theatre director, actors are my medium. And I often get very frustrated when you watch television and film and you see actors just doing such superficial acting. And every now and then you see someone go a bit deeper. And I think what's great about this is that Cal tells a huge story and with very, very little, you know what I mean? It's so subtle the way he performs. And the way it's edited and put together, and yet he manages to give it this kind of depth. And I think Paul and I would agree on that. That the all power to him for doing that.
No, I mean I said to Cal, he said things with his performance I could never write. You know, yeah. I mean, it was I didn't filming it. On the, you know, when we were filming this, I was doing everything and anything other than watching what was going on, because I just, whatever you were employed to do, you were doing it. I was making sure everything was running smoothly. So I didn't really see much of the filming. So the first thing I saw really was the bit of footage of Cal in the car where he gives that look to Bernard, which, you know, if looks could kill. And I just watched that and I thought, oh, you know, I think there's, you know, one of the questions, when did you know that you got something that might be a little bit, and I thought, wow, yeah, that's amazing. And that's the caliber of Cal's acting. I know a lot of actors, I can't think of any really, unless they've got the experience of someone like Cal who could have brought that performance. And, you know, and a lot of people said, yeah, but, you know, it's not, there's not loads of words, you know, there's not loads of dialogue in the film. And it's like, no, because the actors are acting.
Yeah.
You know, they've got chances. And I think that's what appealed to Cal. The fact that it's, you know, you don't go to Asda, buy some beans and then go into a monologue. You know, it's not life, is it? You know, and I hate that kind of thing. And what he brought to it was just, and I mean, listen, the cast was across the board were amazing. Really, really proud of them all. But Cal brought that 20% to the film that I think kind of makes it the level where I'm, you know, really, I mean, I'm proud of it anyway. But he without Cal, we wouldn't have that film. Without
up to that level, yeah. I mean, I 100% agree with you just in terms of the A game that your entire cast and crew kind of brought to this film. But yeah, it very much rests on Cal embodying that journey, being able to communicate so much through movement, through his looks, through just the timing of his delivery, not just the actual words that get spoken. And it certainly adds so much of a dimension, especially when the themes of the story are rooted so much in what a person's personal experience is looking back on what they've done.
And it's in his eyes for me. I mean, acting is anyway, but it's just in his eyes. It's just I mean, you know, you do, and you know, there's not many things that really kind of not inspire me or impress me, because I've been around a long time, but watching someone do that is, especially when you're talking to them, you know, you're talking to them a couple of minutes before, and then boom, that, and you think, wow, yeah, okay, I get it now.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely, absolutely. And with all of that being the case, the fact that you had such an amazing team putting this kind of a film together, what are some of your thoughts on the access to the arts for people wanting to do the kind of work that your team has done? You know, what are your thoughts in terms of how easy or difficult it is to actually go down a road that would lead someone to that level of excellence and to be able to make a living off being that excellent at doing what they do, especially given the importance of a story like this as well?
Yeah, go on, Jake.
Yeah,
so not to set you up, but you know, I just kind of laid on it. Yeah,
Paul's delegating it to me because it's something I feel really passionate about, and I've written about it. I think the kind of summarized version I would say is that so I've been working in the arts all my life, 30 years. I never thought I'd say that, but there we go. It's always been a struggle financially to do that, and I've worked in big theatres. Do you know, I run my own company. I suppose the short version is that I've seen a massive change. So I started in the 90s, grew up formatively with parents working in the theatre, in the 80s, which was the period when there was a massive battle in the country about arts subsidy. So after the Second World War, I don't know if you know how much about this, the Arts Council was set up during the Second World War by Churchill and Clement Attlee. Because they knew the arts were a vital part of the morale of the country fighting the Second World War. And after the Second World War, Attlee decided, and that's where the famous quote that Churchill said, if the arts are not why we're fighting this war, why are we fighting it? Do you know the whole point? So they went to people like Olivier and Gielgud and John Mills and all these different people. And that's when films like Henry V got made, theatre touring the country, people on the radio, inspiring the country, all of this kind of stuff. And after the war, Attlee decided to formalise it and created the Arts Council. And this massive revolution happened across the country, which also was to do with education, where huge amounts of working class people suddenly became actors and directors and writers. And we had theatres in every city, stuff was touring everywhere, and we had a film industry and all these different things. And it was in the 80s that this battle happened, where I don't want to get all political, but a particular government, we all know who was in charge in the 80s, started to cut that subsidy, and it's been dying ever since. And so there's a huge struggle now for people to it's very hard to make a living in the arts. Simple things like having repeat fees taken away. So you could make it back in the day, you could be in Doctor Who and you could live off that for the rest of your life while you did theatre and everything else. But the real shock was during COVID, and what got us through COVID, if it wasn't the arts, the NHS kept us alive physically. And the arts kept us alive mentally. It was Netflix, it was television, it was stuff, people going online and creating work, it was music, it was all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it emerged that the creative industries in this country are our second biggest financial sector after the city by only about 10 million. It's huge, the creative sector.
Wow.
So for the first time, it became really clear that the arts weren't this weird, funny luxury that weren't jobs, but actually this was a massive motor for the country economically as well as spiritually and emotionally. Do you know what I mean? I feel very, very, very strongly that in the last budget, Jeremy Hunt made the tax breaks for theatre and film much, much better. Starmer is talking about investing in the arts because it's the one sector in our country which we could really boost.
Yeah.
What I mean. But at the moment, the Arts Council subsidy for the country is less than half a billion.
Wow.
For the whole of England and Wales, less than half a billion. Double that and see how much money you make out of it.
Yeah.
The thing that's happened is that essentially working class people or lower middle class people are squeezed out of the arts now. They can't afford to train. They can't survive as artists without another source of income. So we're going back to a kind of, unfortunately, moneyed arts. There's nothing wrong with money. I mean, I'm not working class. I'm privileged background, all of that kind of stuff. But if we want representation, we've got to invest in the arts. So the last thing I'll say is I live up in the Northeast. This morning, before this, I was doing 3 hours of workshops on Shakespeare in an academy in Darlington. And this academy had something like, they told me, 50% premium kids. In other words, 50% kids from economic backgrounds that were so tough that they were getting free school meals.
Right.
Teachers said to me, you are the only access we've got to Shakespeare in the whole of the Northeast.
Wow.
So I'm doing Shakespeare later in the year with my company. They said, if we want to take our kids to go and see Shakespeare, the nearest place we can take them is Stratford, which is hundreds of pounds to get a bus, to buy a ticket, to get accommodation. After that, there's London, which is even further. It's 150 quid on a ticket return. That's before you have somewhere to stay. So we're basically saying that whole chunks of the country are being denied, Phil, the opportunity. If you're an artist up in the Northeast, if you're an actor or a director, and you can't afford to go to Manchester to train or Birmingham or London, that's it. But my view very strongly is that there are green shoots. There's a whole new film studios being built in Sunderland. There's new film studios opened in Hartlepool. There's huge potential. I do think the arts, we should be investing in them. I feel really passionately about it because the arts are about culture. They're about history. They're about legacy. They're about future. They're about integration. They're about social mobility. There are all these things. I think very passionately we need to be investing in them. I remember when I found that information out about the economic sector, because Napoleon famously said that England is a nation of shopkeepers. You then realize they're a nation of shopkeepers and artists. You know, so I mean, the UK is an incredibly creative country. But we don't think of ourselves that way because we don't think of things like pop music as art. Do you know what I mean? When people say art, they think, oh, opera, ballet. No. Art is pop music. It's dance. It's rap. It's theatre. It's school theatre. It's all of it. Yeah.
Mate, it's a really, really difficult situation. I kind of stay away. We've had this discussion before, Jake, and I kind of stay away from the working class situation and whatever. I'm just all about doing whatever you can to level the playing field so that everyone's got the same opportunity. And then it's down to talent. And I get that, you know, some people can enhance that talent because they've got money and they don't have to have a part-time job. I get all that, but there's stuff that you can put in place to subsidise that. But it is about just levelling that playing field, and we're nowhere near it. I see it, you know, I've got a mental health charity, involved in, you know, we were involved in the arts and culture in Manchester. And it's ridiculous. It's all about bums on seats. It's not about giving voices to people in the community who don't have a voice. I see it on a day-to-day basis. It's pretty soul destroying, but I still think it's never been easier to go out there and make something. No matter what it is, try and make the best version of what you want to do. That's what I say to people. You can make a really good film on a phone now, you know. So there are opportunities, you know, and we've not had much, you know, in terms of Manchester, have we had any of the great and good in Manchester getting behind a visit? No, we haven't. It's been really poor. Maybe it's a subject matter. Don't know. But considering we've got, you know, Lee Child involved in this as an exec producer, Lee gives us that global platform, really, because of, you know, Lee's opened doors and people have watched his film who would never have watched it. And that, and to me, that's important for the cast and the crew. First and foremost, it's got them in front of some really serious people. But, you know, there's a lot of, I've never really thought about it, but there's a lot of kudos in the fact that Lee felt passionate enough, and he didn't have to do it, felt passionate enough about the story and what I was trying to do that he said, right, okay, I'll get involved. And
what was it that got him involved? How did you bring the project to his attention?
I didn't know. I always thought Lee Child was American. Didn't know he was born in Coventry.
Right.
Read an article because his biography had just been published by a lady called Heather, who's a really good friend of mine who really helped make this happen. And he worked at Granada in Manchester, the big TV studio, from the early 70s until just after the bomb. So there was a lot of that Manc DNA. Now, when I found that out, you know, I'm a bit of a chancer when it, by nature. So it was, got in touch with Heather. I basically said, listen, I've got this script. I wasn't interested in any money at that point. It was just the thought maybe you could open a door, maybe you could share it on social media, something. And obviously Heather sussed me out because she wrote his autobiography. So she was obviously sussing me out to check I wasn't a nutcase. So these, you know, we had a few conversations too. And then she said, well, I'd sent the script to Heather. She liked it. And because she spent a lot of time with Lee and she knew about his Manchester background and what he thought, and she said, I think you'll like this. So, you know, I'll send it through to him. She did. He got straight back to me, told me the reasons why it resonated with him, and said, yeah, I'd love to get involved. And what that allowed me, but, you know, he's an old shop steward at heart. You know, he was a shop steward at Granada when in the 90s they were making all these redundancies. And he was involved in that. He was completely pissed off. So one afternoon he went to the Arndale in Manchester, bought some legal pads and some pens, and that's when he started writing Jack Reacher. So that's where Jack Reacher was born.
Amazing.
So there's that connection, yeah. But that kind of, there are other people out there. This is what I keep saying to people, is like, be ambitious.
Yeah.
You know, be ambitious. Approach people lightly. They're no different than anyone else. To me, they're the easiest people to deal with. The ones who are really difficult, the ones who've not had any success, who've not made anything, who think they're there, not the ones who've actually achieved it. But approach these people and say, listen, I'm looking to do this. Do you want to get involved? And there are plenty of people out there, but we've got to make high quality product first and foremost, and I'll call it product because it is, and it's got to look professional, and it's got to be entertaining. It's not got to be about, I mean, don't get me wrong, the Visit isn't a comedy by any stretch of the imagination, but it can't just all be doom and gloom. There's hope at the end of the Visit, even though it's only a glimmer, but we need that. You know, and if we do that and we can create that platform, then people will start putting money into it because they'll think that they'll get money back, some of them, because we can create a product that will sell. That's what I say to people. It is really, really hard, but stop whinging about it and try and do something about it. And, you know, wherever I can help, I will, as Jake will. And there's lots of other people in the industry will. But they've also got to support each other. The creative people are rubbish at supporting each other. You'll see that, Nigel. I mean, how many people have you worked with and promoted and supported? And they won't share. You know, you put this post out about this film or Cameo or whatever, and you're thinking, why aren't they sharing it? Because they're not involved in it. That's why they're not sharing it. So they don't help themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I would counter that to say that, yes, there are a lot of people that won't get on board, that won't offer support, but there are also a lot of people out there that know how hard it is and know how much, you rely on people to shout about what it is you're doing. And they are really, really willing to promote people when they see they're working harder and see they're producing really great stuff. They will absolutely support other people, but a lot of people I've spoken to have spoken about having to find your tribe, though, because, you know, you will come across a lot of people that just, you know, you're banging your head against a brick wall trying to get some kind of collaboration going on, and other people that you just kind of fortuitously just meet at a bar and, you know, just end up being like great creative collaborators for the next 20 years, you know.
Yeah, 100%,
there's a lot out there, but, you know, it does require there to be energy kind of pumped into those creative endeavors in order to keep people doing that so they can find those tribe members in the future. And speaking of the future, what is what's next for you guys? You mentioned that you're working on the feature version of The Visit. Is that sort of like the main focus at the moment, or are there other short films in the pipeline?
It's one of them, yeah. I mean, the film has got the working title Skithana, which is Gaelic for shadows. There's a Gaelic proverb, which I think it is, if I get this, I'm not going to say it in Gaelic. All sins cast long shadows, and that kind of sums up the kind of where I'm going with the story. So that's a big part of looking to do. It's first feature length script that I'm doing. It's really right. Bloody hard.
Yeah.
Changed it a few times. Changed it completely after spending time in Belfast. In terms of the tack that I was taking. So yeah, working on that. Lee will read and support me on that.
Wonderful.
Which is great. Hopefully he can open some doors. Don't know. We've got another short film. We're looking to start filming in, getting everyone together now, so probably around August, called Gone Fishing.
Yeah.
We've got Rhys Dinsdale and Ian Poulston Davis. Is that as the two leads? That's another one written by me and produced by me. Men's mental health. So yeah, they're the two main things, and some of the bigger projects. I'm not working on anything small because, you know, I'm at that age where I, 20 years ago, I could get this really big body of work and make all these short films. But, you know, I know I keep saying this, but I haven't got that time. So, you know, the projects that I'm working on are massively ambitious. But then you think, well, why not?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know, why not? So, yeah, that's where I am, mate.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. Really well, look forward to seeing more about that. What about yourself, Jake? What's next on the cards for you?
So kind of a billion things at the moment. The next stage production is Othello, the Shakespeare, which we're going to be touring across the north this September, October with my company. We're not going to Manchester because nobody wanted it, but we are going to Lancaster. We are going to Ormskirk. We're doing Yorkshire. We're doing the northeast. And it ends in Durham for the second Durham Shakespeare Festival, which is going to be great. And then in the new year, I've got a new play called The Moth by Paul Hertzberg, which is a stage version of a monologue that we produced during COVID, which ended up going global and was seen all over the world in different film festivals, won an award in Harlem. That is coming to Manchester. That's going to be in Manchester for a week at the Lowry. I'm also running my company as an engagement company. We're just... At the moment, we've launched a thing called Shakespeare for All, which takes Shakespeare out to schools. I've just completed my own another feature script. I've written a number of screenplays and TV pilots, which my agent is waiting to pitch. And I'm hoping to make another short film next year. We'll see. And I also do children's bar mitzvahs and wedding parties.
Yeah, painting and decorating. Exactly. No job too small.
Plenty to be getting on with. Well, I'll be doing a production of Frankenstein and reviving a production of Christmas Carol after I've done the Othello. So it's going to be a busy year.
Have you scheduled any time for sleep?
What? What is this? Yeah, I do my best for the sleep. I do my best.
Okay, I hope so, because we definitely want to see what you guys do next. It all sounds absolutely fantastic. As is this film. Thank you so much for talking to us about it. If people want to follow what you're up to, can they follow you online, social media, anything like that? Where's the best place to keep track of?
Yeah, the website is mankmay.productions, and all the socials are on there. And I just want to say as well, before you, if you're looking to wind this up, that I think what Cameo are doing is really impressive. I really love what you're doing. I can tell. I mean, I've seen you as you've been growing this over the last few months, well, longer actually, and you obviously care about film. That's pretty obvious. And I have a love-hate relationship with festivals. I must be honest. And there aren't many that I would recommend getting involved in for various reasons, but I really do. And listen, you've already wrote the review for the film, so I'm not trying to kiss arse here. But I just, you know, I wanted to say that I think what you're doing is really, really special and really needed.
Oh, I appreciate that. I mean, when, you know, we see stuff like The Visit and all the other films that we've highlighted, it really does underscore the fact that people are out there, they're slogging their guts out, they're telling really interesting stories, and quite often people don't know where to go to find them, or even that they are there to be found. So in whatever small way we can put them in a place so people can experience them, that's more than enough for us. So thank you very much. I appreciate you saying that.
No worries.
So yeah, so my theatre company's website is www.elysiumtc.co.uk. Elysium spelled E-L-Y-S-I-U-M, because we're called Asylum Theatre Company, all sorts of places. Asylum Theatre Company is quite a good name. But yeah, so that's where you'll find us. We're also on Instagram and Twitter, or X, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And obviously I'm on Facebook as Jake Murray, so all my stuff is there. We have a page and a Facebook group called with all our news.
Brilliant. Well, we'll pop all of those links in the description of this episode. And thank you once again, both of you, for joining us today. It's been great speaking to you. It was great watching The Visit. We look forward to sharing it far and wide, and look forward to seeing what you guys do next. To all of our audience, thank you very much for joining us once again for this episode. As usual, you can keep up to date with us on the socials at Cameo Launch on Facebook, Twitter/X, Instagram, and YouTube. Head to cameolaunch.com to sign up to our newsletter to get all of the latest updates, news, reviews, interviews from our platform, and also keep track of what's happening with our upcoming festival this October. So thank you all once again for joining us. You all take care of yourselves, and we will see you next time.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks, mate.